Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 10 of Lex Out Loud, World Building for Science Fiction. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. I'm working on my third novel, my first science fiction novel, and taking you along with me for the ride. And in season one, we're exploring world building in depth. So today I'm continuing our series on future Earth history. We're going to talk about the moon and Mars. So excited to get into that. I'm kind of a bit on a high right now. I just got done watching the test flight of the latest Starship prototype, the SN9. And it was quite a spectacular flight. So if you haven't been watching these and you're into this kind of thing, I really highly recommend it. SpaceX has footage of it on their YouTube channel. And I did not see a live stream for them before the thing actually started. But there's one now. So I'm not sure what's up with that. Usually they put those up ahead of time, you know, before the event. So I'm not sure why it was different this time. So I actually ended up watching it on Everyday Astronaut's YouTube channel, which he's got an excellent YouTube channel. If you want to check that out, he does a lot of stuff on rocketry and aerospace and keeps up with SpaceX and all the other exciting things happening in the space race right now. So it's an excellent YouTube channel if you want to check that out. And while I'm talking YouTube channels, in addition to SpaceX and Everyday Astronauts channels, another great one to follow is NASA Spaceflight. And that's a group of people that provide most, if not all, of the footage that we see of what's going on with the Starship over at Boca Chica, Texas. So I have those three YouTube channels linked in the show notes over at starwalkerseries.com/LOL. Highly recommend you check those out. A lot of interesting and exciting things going on right now. And these launches are a lot of fun to watch. So the Starship is the rocket that SpaceX is building to take us to Mars, among other things. It's going to be used for a lot of things. And they're doing test flights of prototypes now. So my understanding is they're still testing, just getting it up to altitude. Today they went up to 10 kilometers, I think, in altitude. They're testing the flight controls and the belly flop maneuver. So for those of you who are older like me, remember the space shuttle days, when the space shuttle would come back to Earth, would re-enter the atmosphere, it would glide down and land like an airplane. The Starship, on the other hand, is going to land like a rocket. So it's going to use a rocket landing. I'm blanking on the technical term for that. But we'll land similar to how the Falcon 9 and the Falcon Heavy rockets land that SpaceX also builds. So the Starship will land like a rocket. However, in order to slow down on reentry, instead of using parachutes, it does what they're calling the belly flop maneuver, where it basically just rolls over on its belly and to create more drag. And uses that to slow down. And in the last few seconds, it rights itself and fires its engines to slow down the final little bit and land. Ultimately, the Starship is going to have a booster rocket under it called the Super Heavy, I believe is what it's called now. It used to be called the BFR, the Big Falcon Rocket, or some people had another name for it. You can probably guess what that was, but I'll try to avoid the explicit tag for today. But yeah, I think it's called the Super Heavy. So the Starship that you're seeing launching ultimately will, when going to Mars or say the moon, will be sitting on top of a really big lifter rocket that they're still working on. And I think we're going to start seeing test flights of that soon too. So ultimately, this thing will go up in two stages, and the booster stage, the Super Heavy rocket, will come down and land and be reused. And then the Starship rocket also lands and is reused. So really cool stuff. Really, really fun to watch these tests. Like I said, right now, I believe they're still working on control surfaces and the maneuvers and whatnot. They're not so much focused on landing right now. So actually landing the thing successfully at this point would be icing on the cake. It's not really something they're shooting for. And like the SN8, the SN9 did not stick the landing this time and created quite an impressive fireball. So these are uncrewed. They're automated. So there's no loss of life involved with these tests, thankfully. So everybody's okay. So it's a pretty spectacular thing to watch. Also, before we get into our roadmap again today, I want to give a quick thank you and shout out to our new Tier 2 patron, Robert. Thank you so much, Robert, for joining our Patreon. And I hope to see you in the writer's room on our Discord server. And thank you again to all the patrons. Really, really appreciate it. So as I said before, we are going back to our future history of Earth series. So if you're new, you might want to check out the previous episodes for the stuff on getting into low Earth orbit and cislunar space, which is what I've talked about so far. Today, I'm going to try to cover the moon and Mars. We'll see how far we get. And gonna be going through this a little more quickly now. We spent a lot of time, especially on the cislunar space, because that's where I've spent a lot of time as far as my world building and thinking about what I'm doing. But I'm afraid that these future history episodes are getting too dry and boring. So I'm going to try to move a little quicker. And also, I just have less to say about the moon and Mars anyway. All right. So again, I am referencing the Roadmap to Space Settlement, which was published by the National Space Society. And I will have that linked in the show notes as well. You can go read it on the web, or better yet, download the PDF so you can see the full-size images, which the artwork is awesome. I recommend checking this out, if only for the artwork. However, if you are wanting to write something science fiction like I am, and if you're wanting to set something in the recognizable future, you know, not something like Star Trek that's so far in the future that it's unrecognizable, but something more realistic, more down to earth, more like hard sci-fi or mundane sci-fi. So if you're doing something like that where you care about realism and you care about what will our future in space look like, this is the best resource I've found for that kind of thing. Takes us all the way up to interstellar flight and kind of gives step by step what we would need to do, in what order, what that would look like. And so I am using this roadmap literally as a roadmap to guide me through developing my setting, which my setting is the solar system, and turning forward the clock. I'm still not sure exactly how far in the future I'm going to be. I'm, you know, just a gut feeling guess at this point. I guess maybe 300 years. Maybe more, maybe less, but around there, maybe. I could be way off. I don't know. I need to work on that still. But that kind of my gut feeling is maybe around 300 years in the future, our solar system. So that's the setting for these books that I'm writing. So that's what I've been researching and just trying to figure out what does the solar system look like? Where are there human settlements? What are they like? What kinds of resources do we have access to? What kind of technology do we have? What things can we do? What things are still, you know, beyond what we can do, maybe on the horizon or maybe out of reach, that kind of thing. So if you're doing anything remotely like that, I highly recommend this document. It's been a huge asset. So we are picking up where we left off this week with the moon, and beginning with milestone number 18, which is robotic confirmation of lunar resources. So we already know that there's a lot of resources on the moon that we can use. Things like lunar ice, volatile deposits, oxygen, water, titanium, aluminum, helium-3, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. However, you know, the knowledge that we have is mainly from observing the moon from here on Earth using telescopes and various instruments, and from the Apollo missions and the samples they brought back. So there's still a lot that isn't known, and there's a lot that needs to be confirmed. For instance, the ice on the poles of the moon, you know, we haven't actually looked at that. We haven't actually gotten a sample of that to see what that's like. The water on the surface of the moon, I think we just have estimates of how much of that there is, how plentiful it is, things like that. So basically, this milestone is just confirming what resources actually exist on the moon, you know, how plentiful they are, where they are, things like that. And it's anticipated that most, if not all of this will be done robotically. And to give us the information that we need, not only to know for sure what resources we can exploit from the moon, but also to decide the best place to build a lunar outpost or a lunar mining base. So we can consider this milestone accomplished when we have enough data, including the locations of water deposits and other resources on the moon. And we have enough of this data to make a smart choice as far as where we want to build our lunar bases and outposts. And, you know, something that's probably going to come more in maybe the next milestone, which is lunar research and development, but I'll just mention it now because I'm thinking of it, is, you know, there are some other things we need to clarify about some of the resources on the moon. For instance, I've been doing a lot of research lately into these large orbital habitats and how those would be built. And you may remember in previous episodes, I think a question that's come up more than once on this show that I've been wondering is about titanium, because the best thing to make these things out of until we can create or manufacture graphene is titanium. And I wasn't sure how plentiful of an element titanium is here on Earth, and whether there would even be enough titanium to build something like Kalpana 1. So I've since learned that actually there's titanium on the moon. And now I've blanked on the name of the ore. So the titanium on the moon is mainly found in an ore, I think it's called, a mineral called ilmenite, which actually doesn't exist on Earth, which contains iron, titanium, and oxygen. And there is a theoretical process to refine titanium from this ilmenite. But because this doesn't exist on Earth, we haven't been able to actually test this process to make sure it works yet. So that would be another one thing that would need to be tested. We need to get a hold of enough of this lunar ilmenite that we can try refining titanium out of it and see how that goes. Also, we could possibly refine iron out of it and also oxygen. So yeah, that's one thing. Another thing is there's a lot of silica on the moon, which we can use to make glass for our habitats if we're going to actually put windows in them, which I don't think you would, but maybe you would. I don't know. But probably more to the point, we'd use silica in making solar cells, solar panels. So this is another thing that we don't know about, because the silica on the moon is different from the silica on Earth. And it's believed that it's possible that glass made from lunar silica might have kind of a smoky gray appearance, may not be completely clear. So that's something else we need to figure out, is what does glass look like that we make from material from the moon? And can we make a perfectly clear glass from lunar materials or not? So those are other things that we would need to know. And we're not going to be able to know those kinds of things until we can confirm what's actually on the moon, what those resources are. And then we need a permanent presence on the moon so we can start experimenting with refining these various things and seeing what we can do with them. Which brings us to milestone number 19, which is a lunar research and development facility. So this would be a crewed facility that would study human habitation on the moon and away from Earth. It would test various equipment and technologies, including mining of lunar resources. So that would include mining for this ilmenite and trying to refine titanium out of it, mining for silica and trying to make glass out of it, seeing how that goes, as well as various science investigations on the moon. So really important stuff. And we can consider this milestone achieved when significant scientific results are returned. And depending on the amount of various things that we find on the moon, perhaps a commercially significant amount of lunar water has been extracted and processed. So that's the hope right now. We do know there is water on the moon in the regolith, but we don't know exactly how much and how, if we're going to be able to extract and process that and use that, and how much we'll be able to of that we'll be able to get, and how expensive and difficult it will be. So those are answers that this lunar R&D facility would, or those are questions that this lunar R&D facility would hopefully answer. Then milestone 20 is a continuously occupied multi-purpose lunar base. And now we're really talking. So the way they kind of see this happening is our initial lunar facility, our R&D facility, over time evolving and growing into a permanently occupied, ever-expanding lunar base, and or perhaps an additional base created at another site. Using what has been learned from initial research and development and increasingly performing commercial functions such as the production of rocket fuel from volatile deposits on the moon and the shipment of that fuel to lunar orbit and ultimately to Earth orbit. So this milestone can be considered achieved when we have a true lunar settlement on the moon, or the multipurpose base has been continuously occupied for at least a decade. So this is another kind of time point when I'm figuring out my final timeline, you know, just for this milestone 20 to be considered complete, we need a base on the moon for at least 10 years. Milestone number 21 then is a permanent lunar settlement. So as lunar habitation grows in volume, area, and the number of modules connected nearby, and of course, as it grows in population, lunar settlements will eventually reach a point of permanence. While it's hard to define exactly what would make a settlement permanent, some aspects that might need to be present are things like people moving to the moon with no intention of ever returning to Earth. Residents on the moon other than employees. Children being brought to the moon, and gravity and other conditions permitting, being born and raised on the moon. And if you remember from my discussion a while back, we were talking about human reproduction away from Earth, and the moon has much lower gravity than Earth. So at this point, we do not know if human conception and reproduction and child development and all that, we don't know if it's even possible in a lower gravity. And even if it's possible, we don't know if there would be any downsides to that. We don't know yet. It seems a pretty safe assumption that things are going to go wrong in lower than 1G. I mean, we've evolved for millions of years in 1G. I mean, it'd be crazy to think that all these biological processes and reproduction is incredibly complex, to think that that's going to function normally in 0G or even low G. It'd be pretty crazy to think that, I think. So, yeah, I don't know. I kind of personally, I don't think there's going to be children being born on the moon, because unlike our rotating space habitats, there's no easy way to create artificial gravity on the moon. So you're kind of stuck with the gravity that you have on the moon, which is a lot less than Earth. So yeah, you know, for my book personally, right now I'm thinking I probably won't have people being born on the moon. It'll just be adults there, and you know, people won't live their whole lives there probably. So going on, commercial businesses, including manufacturing and markets on the moon, schools and other gathering places, surgical and medical facilities, closed or controlled ecological life support systems, which they abbreviate CELSS. Maybe that's pronounced cells. I don't know. They recycle sufficiently to minimize the amount of imports needed for daily living, including food. Some form of local governance. The ability to make most repairs using local materials. Facilities for visitors, whether those visitors are scientists, tourists, or whatever. And also use as a staging point and support facility for the development of other lunar settlements. So these are all things that we'd probably want to see in place to consider a settlement on the moon a permanent settlement. So we can consider this milestone achieved when the lunar settlement has been occupied for several decades with a population that is stable or growing. So again, you know, milestone 20, we needed a base on the moon for at least a decade. Milestone 21, we need a base for at least several decades. So, you know, you're talking what, a minimum 40 years for milestone 2021, probably more, but minimum of 40 years. So those are our moon milestones. So really, I mean, what this all boils down to simplify things here, is we just want permanent bases on the moon in order to mine resources from the moon that we can use to build our space solar power satellites and to build our habitats in low Earth orbit, in lunar orbit, in cislunar space, and elsewhere. Because again, it takes less energy, believe it or not, to move stuff from the moon over to Earth orbit than it does to move something from the surface of Earth to Earth orbit. So really, in order to be able to expand throughout the solar system, our first step has got to be getting established on the moon, being able to mine resources from the moon that we can use to build our Kalpana cylinders and things like that, as well as to be able to get rocket fuel from the moon to fuel our ships. And yeah, just all of the infrastructure and everything that needs to be put in place to make that work and to make that a sustainable thing on the moon. And like all of our settlements in space, ultimately, we want our lunar settlements to be as independent and self-sufficient as possible. All right. So really quickly, I'm going to go on to Mars here because I think I've got time and I'm just going to power through this because I'm thinking, at least for the first book, there's not probably going to be a whole lot going on Mars yet. There will probably be a human settlement there. In fact, let me look at my notes I got right over here. Yeah, I'm thinking at the point that my first book starts, there will be a space station in orbit of Mars and a surface base on Mars and an asteroid mining base on a near Mars asteroid. But that's probably going to be about it as far as Mars, at least at the beginning. And more what I'm thinking with this project, which is going to be a whole series of books, more and more what I'm thinking is maybe not every book, but periodically through the series, I'm going to advance the timeline because I really like the idea of showing how a lot of this happens. So right now, and I'll go more into detail on this in a future episode, but right now, what I'm thinking is at the beginning of the first book, we're pretty well established in cislunar space and on the moon. And like I said, we're just starting to stretch out to Mars. And I'm going to tell some stories in that time period. And then once I've had enough of that, I can go forward in time a bit to perhaps when we've moved on to the asteroid belt and we're terraforming Mars, and then tell some stories in that time period. And then I can move forward even more to when we're establishing presence on some of the outer planetary moons, like the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, and moving out to the outer solar system. And keep going forward in time occasionally until eventually I get to the point where we're sending ships to other stars. So that's kind of the plan. And it's a very long-term plan. You know, I'm thinking more than one novel in each of these kind of discrete time periods. I don't know how many until I've said what I have to say, I guess. And then there's even the possibility of doing some kind of prequel kind of stuff. Because I do think it'd be fun to tell a story about Kalpana 1 or one of these really early, one of the first orbitals that are built that are smaller with populations in the thousands instead of the millions. But that's not where I want to start, because really what I see this, the overall story being about is these huge cities in space with populations in the millions. So that's really, to me, that's the core of what this is about. So I don't want to give people the wrong impression by starting out with this much smaller orbital that only has a few thousand people and feels more like a frontier town than a city, because then people, you know, your first impression is what sticks with you. So I want to give a first impression that's more true to what I think this is going to be about overall, and save a story about one of the earlier settlements for kind of a prequel kind of thing. But at least that's what I'm thinking right now. This is all open to change, of course. All right, so let's go on to Mars. Milestone number 22 is robotic exploration of Mars for local, which is to say in situ resources. And this is the same thing as what we were just talking about with the moon. We need robots on Mars to confirm the resources that are there, especially water ice, and to help us pick the best spots for future settlements on Mars. You know, the Curiosity rover is already there doing its thing. The new rover Perseverance is on its way. At time of recording, I believe it launched about 6 months ago, and I think it's going to get to Mars within a few weeks. Perseverance is really interesting because it's going to be the first rover that we're going to be able to get some samples back from, which will be super cool. To my knowledge, nobody on Earth yet has actual samples from Mars yet. So that'll be pretty cool. And of course, we'll be poring over those for any signs of any microscopic life that may have existed at any time in Mars history. And wouldn't that be amazing to find? But yeah, so milestone 22, first objective of this, which is scientific knowledge, of course, may never be completed because that's, you know, scientific investigation is ongoing and open-ended. But the second objective, which is exploration and outpost data, can be considered achieved when there's agreement on at least three viable surface sites for human development, all of which have a source of water ice nearby. So that's what we're shooting for with milestone 22. Milestone 23 is an integrated Martian space transportation and logistics system. Now, this is cool stuff. This is just the kind of stuff I just nerd out on. I don't know why. I just love transportation and trade, I guess. So this is a system capable of safely transporting humans and cargo from Earth or cislunar space to the Martian surface, enabling us to maintain crew on the surface of Mars and enabling us to send people to Mars, bring people back to Earth from Mars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this can be considered achieved when cargo and crews can be moved from Earth or cislunar space to Mars orbit or surface, and can move between Mars orbit and surface back and forth between the two, and can be sustained on the Martian surface safely during at least an approximately 500-day stay. And that number is chosen because of the amount of time between the windows when you can get from Earth to Mars. And this isn't something I don't know the super in depth, but very simply, due to the nature of the orbit of Earth and the orbit of Mars around the sun, I believe it's a couple times a year that, or maybe it's only once a year. I think it's twice a year, but anyway, periodically the two planets are closer together than they normally are. And that is the best time to send someone to Mars or to bring someone back, because it greatly shortens the journey they have to take, which shortens the amount of time they have to be in deep space exposed to cosmic radiation and whatnot. And it also decreases the amount of fuel that you need and all that stuff. So those are really the only times it's at all possible right now to go from Mars to Earth or vice versa. So anyone we send to Mars needs to be able to stay there long enough to wait for the next window to come back. So that's where that 500 days comes from. I'm sure that's leaving lots of padding for safety. And then we need the crews able to safely leave the Martian Earth surface and then return to Earth. And again, to consider this milestone completed, we need this transportation system in use safely for at least 3 successive crews over 7 years between Mars orbit and surface, and able to return them to Earth safely. And also, the various steps of this, we want to use propellant or rocket fuel that's actually made on Mars. So we want our ships that are leaving Mars to come back from Earth getting their fuel from Mars, from fuel that's made on Mars. That's part of this milestone. All right, next up, milestone 24 is a continuously occupied multi-purpose Mars surface base. So again, we're just kind of echoing our milestones with the moon, just doing the same kinds of things on Mars. So once we found a good location for a base, we need to build a base there. Could be on the surface or could be below the surface. And this base will probably be powered by a combination of solar power and buried nuclear reactors, because there are no fossil fuels on Mars to use, which is just as good. We need to get past using fossil fuels anyway. And this milestone can be considered achieved when a Mars surface base has been continuously occupied for one decade. So again, milestone 23 added at least 7 years to our timeline, and milestone 24 is adding at least a decade. And then milestone 25 is a true Martian settlement. So this has our Martian base evolving into a permanent settlement, increasingly self-sufficient and focused on commercial activities. And this milestone is considered achieved when a growing settlement of at least 1,000 adults has been on Mars long enough for one generation to be born there, who in turn have produced viable children. Now, again, the huge gravity caveat here, because Mars does have lower gravity than Earth. It has more than the moon, but less than Earth. And so this is assuming that having and raising children on Mars is even a possibility, which it's very possibly not due to the whole gravity thing. But we'll find out through further research. And you know what? We've still got some time, so I'm going to go ahead and keep going with this. Let's see how far we can get. So we're going to go on to part 5 of the roadmap, which is asteroid mining and orbital space settlements. So milestone 26 is robotic characterization of asteroids. So this is remote or robotic characterization of near Earth and other asteroid orbits, compositions, and structures. Earth-threatening near-Earth objects composed of useful minerals could be put on a list of objects to be mined to extinction, so there's no remaining body to pose a risk. Radio beacons could also be placed on NEOs, which is near-Earth objects, to make tracking them easier. Now, this is a really, really cool idea that I really love. So we have these NEOs, which again stands for near-Earth objects. There are asteroids that are near Earth that are in solar orbit near our orbit. And, you know, these can present a danger if they get too close to Earth. So this is suggesting putting radio beacons on them so we can more easily track them. And also, I just love this idea of mining them to extinction. You know, that we see all you know, in a lot of science fiction, we always see mining in the asteroid belt. Which obviously that would eventually be a thing, because there's tons of asteroids in the asteroid belt. But what a lot of people don't realize is there are asteroids all over the place, not just in the asteroid belt. And near all the planets, there are asteroids. So there are asteroids near Earth, there are asteroids near Mars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, long before we can exploit an asteroid all the way out in the asteroid belt, we could feasibly exploit asteroids much closer to Earth. And, you know, we do have these asteroids, and some of them might someday become dangerous to Earth. So the idea is, you know, if we have an asteroid like that, that could one day be dangerous, we just mine it until there's nothing left. And now that threat is gone. So I think that's a fantastic idea. And yeah, that's a really cool thing to do. Now, they point out here that investigation of asteroids will be ongoing and will continue as activity expands into the asteroid belt itself, which contains thousands of objects. And partial completion of this milestone can be considered achieved when sufficient knowledge of asteroids exists that allows governments to plan planetary defense, or when mining of surveyed asteroids begins. And we've talked in the past about an asteroid defense system for the Earth, and this would be the beginnings of that. Milestone 27 is utilization of asteroids. So after we've found and identified some suitable asteroids, we can have robotic and human crews going to establish mining bases and habitats for temporary occupation of those asteroids to extract resources from them, and perhaps even eventually building permanent human settlements nearby. Proposals have also been made for hollowing out an asteroid and building a rotating space settlement inside of it. This milestone can be considered achieved when asteroid miners and smelters are regularly sending ores or refined products to Earth, the Moon, or Mars, or contributing substantial structural mass to the construction of rotating space habitats. Milestone 28 is the development of orbital space settlements. Now, this is what we're talking about. This is where I've been wanting to get from the beginning. This is kind of where my setting takes off here. So these are orbital cities built in space from asteroid and or lunar materials, not from Earth. Three proposed types of these settlements are the Bernal spheres, or my more preferred version, the cylinder version called Kalpana, the Stanford Torus, and also the O'Neill cylinders. Now, I don't know why they mentioned O'Neill cylinders, because those seem, I don't know. I guess you can make them work if you use the two cylinders together. But to me, I've at least in my mind, I've already crossed O'Neill cylinders off the list. It's just like, why would you build something like that when you can build a Kalpana cylinder that's stable all by itself and doesn't need all this over-engineering of having multiple counter-rotating cylinders balancing each other? It's just more points of failure. So why would you do that? Now, the Taurus thing, the Stanford Taurus, I do think is a good design for a smaller habitat, you know, not so much for a city, but, you know, something like a asteroid mining base, Stanford Taurus would probably be a great design for something like that. And I believe that's probably what I'm doing in my setting. For use in cislunar space, lunar material could be launched using electromagnetic launchers, also called mass drivers. Material mined from an asteroid could be utilized either in an orbit close to that asteroid or could be moved to another desired location. There are thousands of candidate asteroids among the near-Earth objects, some requiring less energy to reach than the Moon. So just near Earth, we have thousands of asteroids that we could use for mining, potentially. Eventually, such cities in space could be located throughout the solar system, orbiting planets or moons, co-orbiting with asteroids at Lagrange points, or in solar orbit. And that's where I'm heading in my setting. This milestone can be considered achieved when a rotating space settlement built primarily from non-terrestrial, which means not from Earth, materials, has a population of at least 1,000, including families and children. Another milestone will be achieved when the total population in orbital space settlements exceeds the population of Earth. So I am thinking for my story, for the beginning of the story, this is where we're at. We've completed milestone 28, and we're getting ready to work on milestone 29. So I'm thinking right now that's where I'm going to start the story. So now at this point, we're getting ahead of the game. But I'm just going to wrap this up really quick, because we're in the home stretch now, my friends. So now we go to part 6, additional expansion and greater sustainability of human civilization. And milestone 29 is terraforming and paraterraforming, which is the modification of other planets or moons or even possibly asteroids to support human, animal, and plant life in a manner similar to Earth. The partial terraforming milestone, which covers several different situations, can be considered achieved when the climate and atmosphere of at least a substantial portion of a planet has been changed enough to achieve one or more of the following: preventing harmful levels of radiation from reaching the surface, water flowing on a substantial portion of the surface of a previously frozen planet, rain falling on the surface of a previously dry planet, and plant life germinating and growing on the surface or in the waters of a previously sterile planet. So that's for partial terraforming. The full terraforming milestone will be achieved when humans, plants, and animals can directly breathe the air and work on the surface of a previously oxygen-free planet without pressure suits, oxygen supplies, or radiation protection. So, you know, as I said, I think at the beginning of my series, this is going to be kind of the thing they're working on right now, the newest thing they're going to be working on. Beginning to terraform Mars, I think. But I need to do some more research into terraforming. And, you know, it could be that the terraforming would be farther along than the beginning stages at this point. I'm not sure. I need to do some more research on that. Milestone 30, then, is development of interstellar travel and settlement. Human travel to other solar systems and the establishment of settlements in other star systems or on extrasolar planets in those star systems. And extrasolar planets just means planets around another sun, not our sun, another sun. Detection of habitable or terraformable planets in a star system in advance of a voyage is not required, but may be desirable, whereas the presence of either terrestrial-type planets or asteroids as a material source is required. So the idea here is the reason that we're saying that the presence of a habitable, like say an Earth-like planet, or even a planet like Mars that we could terraform into an Earth-like planet in another solar system at this point in our development is not a requirement, as long as it has terrestrial type, which is to say rocky planets or asteroids. That's all we need, because as long as we have the materials from either rocky planets or asteroids, we can build these orbital settlements, which can hold far, far more than a planet anyway. So at this point in human development, we don't even need an Earth-like planet to go to a star system and live there, because we can live in these huge orbital settlements instead. And I mean, orbital, they could be orbiting the sun. They don't even have to be orbiting a planet or a moon. They can just be orbiting the sun out there. In addition to crew and passengers, interstellar vessels may carry frozen embryos or other forms of genetic data, which can be reconverted into living organisms for genetic diversity. And yeah, that's a whole topic for another day, but it seems highly unlikely that we would send ships with actual people on them to other stars. By the time we're ready to do that, our technology is going to be so advanced that we could potentially just send a ship with a bunch of data on it. And once the ship gets there, it prints DNA and starts growing humans and has AIs to raise the humans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, ideas can get really out there. But sending a bunch of fragile meatbag humans on a ship going a significant fraction of the speed of light on a journey that's going to take decades, yeah, that probably won't happen. That wouldn't be a very smart way to go about things. But yeah, that's, like I said, that could be a whole episode just talking about that kind of stuff. So this milestone can be considered achieved when a human settlement is established and growing in at least one solar system besides our own. And the final milestone in the roadmap is number 31, survival of humanity. Let's try that again. Survival of humanity via space settlement. The general expansion of space settlement increases the likelihood that humanity will survive in the long term, particularly through the development of specific isolated settlements designed to survive and to be as independent as possible. This milestone can be considered achieved when careful analysis concludes that at least some settlements would likely survive recognized existential risks to Earth or elsewhere.
Woo!
We did it. We got through the roadmap. Really powered through the end because, at least for me, what I'm doing, this becomes a little less relevant the farther we go. Because at least for this first book, I'm going to focus on cislunar space. I think a lot will happen there before much, if anything, happens on Mars. And yeah, I'm really excited about these orbital cities and telling a story there. And it's really cool to have this roadmap of things still coming in the future that will be on the horizon that people will be thinking about and working toward in my setting. And then being able to periodically, as time goes on, advance the timeline of my setting a bit and explore these new frontiers that continue to unfold in front of us. So I guess at this point, you know, we've gone through the roadmap and we've kind of got this outline of where things are going, what that's going to look like, the order. And, you know, the order is going, you know, this order isn't necessarily set in stone. So probably what I'll talk about next time is I took this roadmap and I sat down and I distilled it down into a timeline of important events as far as my setting, my story I'm going to tell, important events as far as expansion into the solar system that have happened between today, current day, and when my story begins. And as part of this, I kind of annotated where we're hitting which of these milestones. And, you know, obviously I can't predict the future. You know, who knows if this is the way it'll unfold. But what I came up with does not have all these milestones happening in order. For instance, we start out with milestones 1 and 2, and then we go to milestone 5, and then we achieve milestones 18 to 21, and then we achieve milestones 3 to 4, and then 7, and so on. So it's jumping around quite a bit. So that might be an interesting discussion. And then so through this, I came up with kind of my outline of on page 1 of the first book, this is where we're at. This is where we're at on this roadmap of exploring and settling the solar system. And then as part of that, I wanted to know, what are all the settlements right now beyond Earth? On page 1 of my first book, what are all the various places out there other than Earth that you can maybe go to during the story? And so I came up with that, and I came up with 19 settlements, I guess, for lack of a better term. And then number 20 is the one where the story is going to be set, which number 20 is the first cylinder built of graphene and the first space elevator built on Earth. And that is where the story is going to take place. And yeah, I'll tell you more about that next time. So that's where I'm at. And I've just gotten so much use out of this roadmap. I can't even tell you how valuable this has been to me. Now, I mean, surely I could have come up with my own timeline and figured out where settlements are in the solar system during my story without this. And indeed, I'd already done a lot of that groundwork before I found this. I already had a lot of other research about places where we could build settlements and kind of my ideas of what order, you know, where we'd go in what order. But, you know, this was done by the National Space Society. A lot of smart people, a lot of minds went into this. So obviously they're going to do a lot better than I'm going to do all by my lonesome, of course. And yeah, it's just been invaluable, especially because I want to make this as, quote, realistic as I can. I want my predictions to be as plausible as I can. You know, basing it on this roadmap, I think it is going to let me get there a lot closer than what I would have come up with myself. I probably would have made some decisions that some of these people in the National Space Society would have said, oh, no, that's not the way that would happen. So yeah, I was able to avoid some of those pitfalls from this or through this, which is super cool. And just makes my life easier. And I guess that'll be my parting thought today. Seems to be a recurring theme on this show because I know I've mentioned it more than once. But at least for me personally, as a creator, as a writer, I find constraints highly, highly useful. And to try to do this with just the sky's the limit would have been extremely challenging. And who knows what I would have come up with, how good or not good it would have been. But to have the constraint of this roadmap of saying, you know, I'm going to take this roadmap, these 31 milestones, and use it as my guide for how this is all going to shake out. And which is not to say I can't deviate from this, because I have, but every time I deviate from it, I have a good reason. I'm not just doing it, you know, for shits and giggles. Like I have a well thought out reason anytime I deviate from this. And I've just found that invaluable, you know, having this set of constraints or parameters or lines I've got a color inside of has been very useful, because it gives you some direction, it gives you some structure, but there's still plenty of room for my own creativity, for my own ideas, for my own inspirations, for my own, you know, what I'm excited about. And what am I excited about? Well, I'm excited about a lot of things with this, but two of the big things that I've mentioned before are space elevators and these Kalpana type cylinders. I'm just in love with them. So I knew from the beginning that I wanted those to be front and center in the story, which means the story needs to take place on one of these cylinders. It's at the top of one of these space elevators, or else how's it ever going to be relevant? So right there, that gave me kind of a place that I want to be in the story. And now this roadmap is helping me have a time of where I want to be, which I still don't have a date. Like I said, I have this gut feeling of around 300 years in the future, but I need to sit down and you know, go through this. I went and highlighted in here every time they said, oh, this needs to happen for 10 years, or this needs to happen for so many decades. So I can go back and add all those up to get an idea of what the minimum amount of time it would be. And then I'll use some kind of multiplier, because there's no way this is going to happen in the minimum possible time. I'm sure it will take significantly longer to do than the fastest we could possibly do it, which is unfortunate, but that's just, I think, what the reality is going to be. And yeah, I guess one thing I do want to learn more about, just for my own personal understanding, although I do think it's probably important for the book too, ultimately, is why we're so focused on Mars right now. That's what I don't understand right now. And I want to learn more about it. I want to have an informed opinion about that. Right now, my uninformed opinion, my best guess right now, is it's a PR thing. That the folks at NASA and SpaceX and, you know, everyone else involved, for whatever reason, thinks that going to Mars is something that people will get behind, that people will get excited about, where going back to the moon, not so much. And it's sad, really. Ignorance is really sad, but it's sad, really. You know, how many times when people talk about the Artemis mission, returning to the moon, where you'll hear people say, oh, we've already gone to the moon, who cares? You know, and just the ignorance is kind of astounding. But, you know, when you look at this roadmap and you understand this roadmap, you understand that before we can go to Mars, we need to go to the moon first. And there's a lot we need to do on the moon and in Earth orbit before we go to Mars. Now, I do have a feeling that when we do first go to Mars, whether it's SpaceX or NASA or whoever gets there first, or China, whoever gets there first, I have a feeling it's going to be like Apollo. It's going to be just a plant your flag, take a picture, leave some footprints and go back home, which is unfortunate. So I have a feeling that's what all this is. And meanwhile, you know, we're going to be building the gateway on the moon. We're going to be start working on all this infrastructure we've talked about in this series. And that's going to be happening in the background while we're building up to this Mars mission. But I think maybe the Mars mission is just the big shiny thing to get everybody's attention of like, hey, look at these cool things we're doing to get people on board. So when governments want to spend money on this, people are cool with that. Even though, you know, the future is not government spending money on this, the future is private enterprises. But that's my best guess right now. And that the hope is that it will capture people's imagination. And even if we just go there and put our feet on the ground, take a picture, leave a flag, and that's it, at least it'll get people excited and people want to do more. So, yeah. And I mean, I'm not going to say that's not a valid reason to do it. It might even be a great reason to do it. The more hearts and minds we can get on board with this, the better. So yeah, that's my guess, but I want to learn more so that I know and understand, because at the very least for my setting, I'm going to have to predict for the sake of the book, like what comes out of this. But I just wonder, because going to Mars is a big deal. It's a really long way. And all these things to do in on the moon and in cislunar space are so much easier and so much more achievable right now. I guess my concern is that we send a mission to Mars, something goes horribly wrong, we lose good people, and it blows up in our face, and now nobody wants anything to do with space. And I feel like the possible negative impacts of the Mars mission going badly, which odds are that it would, just because there's so much involved. I think the potential negative impacts of it going badly, to me, seem at least to outweigh the potential positive impacts of it going well, especially when you consider it's more likely to go badly than to go well. So, I don't know. What do you think? What do you all think? What do you think? I'm missing something here. Do you maybe have some information about this that I'm lacking? Or just an opinion? I'd love to hear what you think about the focus on Mars right now, and whether you think these other things are going to happen in the background and first before much more than photo ops are taken on Mars, or what? Let me know what you think. LexOutLoudPodcast@gmail.com. All right. Well, that is going to wrap it up for episode 10. So we ended up covering the moon, Mars, the asteroids, and beyond. And we got through our roadmap today, which makes me happy, because I was worried these episodes were getting a little boring. And now we can move on to other things. And I have a lot of other stuff to talk about, actually. I mentioned in the writer's room on our Discord this weekend that I had quite a eureka moment with my setting this weekend, which is probably what I'm going to talk about next week. But yeah, things are really starting to come together, and it's like a snowball rolling down a mountain. It's just turning into a snow boulder now and picking up speed. So yeah, really exciting stuff. I can't wait to tell you more about it. Again, if you'd like to reach me, if you have any comments or questions, you can email me at lexoutloudpodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter @LexStarwalker. You know, I don't think I've mentioned my Twitter on here at all, have I? Yeah, so if you want to follow me on Twitter, I try to share interesting space-related news that I see on Twitter. And that's most of the stuff I tweet these days. I try to stay away from the political stuff. Maybe once in a blue moon, I might tweet something remotely political. But these days, I used to be a lot more political on Twitter. But since I started this podcast, I decided to refocus on the space exploration stuff. Because anybody listening to this show that comes to Twitter to follow me, we're probably going to be interested in that kind of stuff more than my opinions on American politics. So yeah, you know, if you're someone that followed me back in the day and maybe you stopped because it was getting too political, I'm not doing that anymore. And it's mostly sci-fi and space and tech news and stuff like that now. Plus just updates on what I'm doing with the show and whatnot. So feel free to follow me on Twitter. Man, I cannot talk today. You can also call my voicemail, 951-465-5391. And you can join our community on Discord. Again, you no longer have to be a patron to join the Discord. Anyone can join. However, there is a special writer's room for the patrons. So if you want to support the show, you can get access to the writer's room. And you can find links to the Discord, my Patreon, my email, the voicemail, my Twitter, all that in the show notes at starwalkerceos.com/LOL. So thank you so much for joining me for another episode. And I'll be back next week to talk more about this science fiction goodness that I am just consumed by lately. And until then, keep writing.